I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC original podcast.
The darkest feelings, like the feelings that scared me, were the feelings that I wasn't sure if I wanted that baby.
From CBC, this is Love Me, a show about the messiness of human connection. Episode 4, Falling.
Brian and I had just gotten engaged, and it was a total whirlwind romance. We spent a ton of time on the phone, and we'd sent about 1,000 emails. But the actual time face-to-face that we spent before we decided to get married was about 3 weeks. I quit my job and went to work with him, and, you know, it was while we were working together one day that she showed up. She was totally beautiful. I mean, she had this long, dark hair and these almond-shaped eyes. And she just knew what she was doing as well. I mean, she would kind of, like, bat her eyelashes. She had these ridiculously long eyelashes. She would, like, bat them. And when she saw him, they just had this moment where, like, time stopped. They were just looking at each other, and then she kind of like sashayed past him in this little way that she had. And I mean, from the second Brian saw her, I just knew he was gone. I would sort of, walk up and interrupt them, kind of like giggling together. And, you know, their heads kind of really close, and he would like whisper little secrets to her. It was all just nauseating. They called her Malou, which is short for Marie-Louise, and they said that she was the international model because she'd just come from Paris. She was found in someone's hand luggage going through the X-ray machine at the Charles de Gaulle airport. There is a thriving international black market for great apes, and Malou was a bonobo. Bonobos are an endangered species, and there's probably, not enough left in the wild to fill a football stadium. Malou's mother was killed, and she was probably taken from her dead body and sold on this black market to be destined to be somebody's pet.
No.
That was a real one.
Brian and I were working at Lolea Bonobo, the world's only bonobo sanctuary. It's in this beautiful forest in the middle of Kinshasa in the Congo. We were studying our closest living relatives, which is chimpanzees and bonobos, trying to find out what it is to be human. Both humans and chimpanzees, we're male-dominated, we kill each other, we beat our females, sometimes, we kill the infants. And bonobos, who are so similar to us, they don't kill each other. And they're the only great ape that doesn't kill each other. When bonobos fall in love with you, it's a very specific experience. It's not like the relationship you have with, like, a cat or a dog. And not like chimpanzees. I mean, chimpanzees, they'll just love anyone. But bonobos choose you. Like, they choose one person. And when they do, it's like a laser beam. So when you turn up, it's like you're all they can see and you're the most important person in their world. I'd fallen in love with bonobos a ton of times before. I mean, Brian was always laughing at me. Like, he was always kind of scornful because he was the scientist. Like, he was the real researcher, and he loves all apes for their minds. He wasn't going to sort of get sucked into this kind of, like, ape-hugging type relationship. But then when Malou chose him, he was just helpless. Malu was with all the other infant bonobos. Malu was only five or so. And they hung out all day in this sort of beautiful forest. And so Brian would go up there and you'd squeeze past this sort of little rocky crevice and you'd have to run past the killer bees and hope they didn't wake up. And, you know, there she would be, just kind of, you know, lounging around in the leaves or, you know, eating a mango. And she would see him and her whole face would just light up. But as for me, I was the other woman and she knew it. So she would kind of, you know, squint her eyes at me and give me dirty looks. And, you know, Brian didn't see any of it. We used to eat breakfast outside on the porch, and there was this one morning where Malu must have been watching us, because as soon as Brian went inside to get something or go to the bathroom, she ran down and just knocked over my tea, stole my toast, and then ran off. And then later on, when I went to go up to the nursery, like all my friends were there, the mamas, they were these amazing women who took care of these baby bonobos. And I would be sitting with them and Malu would just launch herself and just kick me in the head. And the mamas would just think it was hilarious. They would go, Vané, Malu, te deteste. I mean, she hates you. And they're like, she'd come running from Kinshasa to kick you in the head. I used to see Brian play this game with her where he threw her up into the air as high as he could. And I mean, he used to play baseball, so I mean, he can pitch. And she would just laugh, she would just die laughing. And she would go completely limp. She would be like 7 feet in the air. I mean, if Brian had dropped her, she would have broken her neck. But she knew that Brian would never, ever let her fall. That no matter what, he would catch her. And it was this kind of trust that for me, it taught me what really being in love was. Because in order to be in love, you have to completely trust that person. Even though you know that you don't have control on whether they catch you or not. After we left the sanctuary, Brian and I moved to America. Malu kept growing, kept flourishing, and there was talk of her being one of the bonobos who was going to be released into the wild. I still remember it was springtime and the dogwoods were flowering and I was sitting outside at a cafe with one of my friends and my phone rings and it's Brian and his voice sounds very strange, it's broken. He just says, Malu's died. I could just hear it. I knew then that he would never love a bonobo again like he loved Malu. He'll never fall in love like that again. A few years later, I found out that I was pregnant with our first baby, and she was a girl. And so I asked him, I'm like, do you want to call her Malu? And he didn't say anything. But he smiled. And that's her name.
The darkest feelings, like the feelings that scared me, were the feelings that I wasn't sure if I wanted that baby. When I was growing up, I had 4 younger siblings, and I think I've always wanted to have kids. Like, I don't even think I ever questioned that. It was just a given. we'd seen a lot of our friends, it had taken a lot of time or they had had miscarriages. And so my boyfriend said, you know, oh God, if this is going to take forever, we're going to have problems. Maybe we should try now. And we started trying, and then we were pregnant literally on the first try. So I had heard so many times from my mom that the 4 days in her life when she had her children were each the best day of her life, and that like it was the most magical feeling, and nothing could ever compare to that. So I was feeling great. Like even once I got to the hospital and the contractions started, I was happy and upbeat. It was painful, but like manageable. And then when it got too painful, I got an epidural, and then I was fine. I slept a bit. And you know, the next morning I woke up and they said, okay, like we're having a baby today. And it really felt doable. During the delivery, we just got stuck. And like for the longest time, I was pushing as hard as I could, and it was excruciating and exhausting. And my really sweet, mild-mannered doctor kept saying, it's very good. She's right there. I could see her hair. I could see her hair. It's very good. And, you know, after a couple hours of that, I was like snapping at the doctor, like, how is this good? And we kind of eventually started noticing that things were maybe not so fine based on how many people were in the room with us. One by one, more nurses started coming in, and then the student doctor was there, and then the main doctor was there too. And I felt like, oh my God, everybody on the floor is in my room right now. There must be nobody out there with anybody else because they're all in this room. To this day, I don't really know what went wrong, but they had to suction her out. It was pretty traumatic for both of us, I think, for her and just for me physically. When they wheeled me out of the delivery room, I was in like crumpled state on a wheelchair, just kind of like huddled and shaking. And I remember going, they wheeled me past the family waiting room, and I couldn't even look up to make eye contact with my family because I knew I was just going to dissolve into tears. But then I was seeing all these other women getting wheeled out of the delivery room, and they were smiling and waving and like walking around. I was in total shock. Like at 3 days, I was still bedridden. I couldn't get out of the hospital bed. When we finally got discharged, I felt like we had made a prison break. Right from the beginning, I definitely felt strongly protective of her. I felt like the two of us had been through a war together. I cared for her. I wanted to care for her. But I didn't really like her that much. There was nothing pleasant about being with her in those first weeks. Like it wasn't like what you see in the Huggies commercial where you're just like staring at a beautiful, silent porcelain baby. You know, she would basically cry if she was awake, if she wasn't eating. Like so those were her states. She was either sleeping, which really only happened for a couple hours at a time. And she would actually cry when I put her on me, which was the most disheartening thing in the world. Like, you know, you're trying to feed your baby and she's crying. And I definitely had a lack of compassion or empathy for her. Jordan and I both felt at different times that this was a huge mistake, that we'd regretted this, that the day that she was born was the worst day of our lives. Babies can't smile when they're born, and it's really awful because all they can do, it's like they only have one emotion, and that emotion is upset. Honestly, we weren't sure if she was going to be a happy person. Like we were looking at her and we were looking for signs that she was going to be able to be a happy person. And it just didn't look like it was there. I just reread my diary, and I think it was 4 weeks in. It was literally me saying, I hate my life right now. Yeah. So this is June 25th. So she was born on May 25th. So exactly a month in. And all I wrote was, I hate my life right now. Breastfeeding is so painful. I dread it. But she cries if she is awake and not eating. And Jordan only says that the baby is the worst and he hates her. You know, when I wrote that down, because I think deep down inside, I knew it was going to change. And then it did. Like the very next thing I wrote was on July 10th. just not that much long later. But I wrote, it took 6 weeks, but I finally fell in love with this baby. When she was about 2 months old, she started smiling, and that literally changed everything. It changed the whole game. I started looking at her when she was crying and thinking, and not feeling angry, but more feeling sad that she was sad, you know. And around that 6 week mark, I remember she was crying really hard for some sort of reason, maybe because we were in the car. I think we had brought her home from somewhere, and she always screamed her head off in the car. And I got her out of the car, and she was freaking out. And I was holding her, and while I was holding her, she stopped crying. And then I really felt like, oh, I made her feel better. Like, I can make her feel better sometimes. I think before, I thought about love, that love was about loving being with a person, like being happy when you were with a person, or liking who you were when you were with that person. And it's weird for me to feel this unconditional love now, like this love that it doesn't matter to me what she thinks of me or what she's like, even. It has nothing to do with who she is or what she does. Like, I'm just going to love her anyways, even though she's still difficult. I look at people now and I think, how have humans survived so long? Every single human being has gone through this, is a product of that process. And yeah, it does feel kind of unlikely that we've been so successful. But here we are.
Love Me is produced by Mira Burt-Wintonik and Crystal Duhame. Today's show featured Love Rival, produced with Jody Taylor. Thanks to Vanessa Woods for sharing her story. To see a photo of Malu, visit cbc.ca/loveme. And to learn more about bonobo protection, visit lolayabonobo.org. You also heard Zena Wright. Original theme music by Tim Kingsbury, scoring music by Murray Lightburn, additional music by Poddington Bear and Chill Carrier. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or at cbc.ca/loveme. If you like what you hear, please review us on iTunes. It would mean a lot, and it really does help. I'm Lou Olkowski. Thanks for listening. Here's a taste of next week's show.
Smile, everybody.
Cheese!
Ah. Ew, and Francie got snot in my hair.
We're going to have to take it again.
Is someone wearing perfume?
She's allergic to scent. Is someone wearing a scent? Soap, breath freshener, potpourri.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.